people back in the day when we were there, there were older people who thought that we were on the wrong path. Some were afraid for us, not that they disagreed with our aims and ambitions, but they were afraid. And then there were others who just didn't believe that we should be doing what we were doing. It goes way back to that debate between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, whether you cast down your buckets where you are or whether you go ahead and challenge the system.
We have 5 seconds.
And so as I look at these young people, I think back on those days, and I think their time has come to pick up the baton and carry it forward, looking for justice and freedom and all the things that they are
Charlene
trying
Hunter
to stand
Gall,
for.
Thank you so much. Part two online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
What are you doing Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m.? Why don't you stop on by so that we can blend? Make a date with the diva. On my show, Lyrical Infusion, each and every Saturday, I bring the lyrics out to play. So I'll meet you here at WHFR 89.3. Saturdays from 2 to 4 p.m. is the place to be. Or listen live at WHFR.fm. It's truly a classic, not a trend. Ooh, I can't wait. Don't be late. At WHFR, we make waves.
When I was little, I didn't talk for a long time. I liked things to always be the same. Anything new or different would scare and upset me. I was very sensitive to lights and sounds. It was almost like I had bigger eyes and ears than everyone else. So I built secret hiding places where nothing could get in. I didn't like looking people in the eye. It made me feel uncomfortable. I'd throw big tantrums over little things, like when my socks didn't match. Sometimes I'd do the same things over and over. Until one day, I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
You can see signs of autism in children as young as 18 months. Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
Love to design stuff and play on the internet? Henry Ford College offers a one-year certificate program in web technologies and design. Advanced HTML, computer art, web authoring tools, and web multimedia are a few of the courses offered.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
The program is designed to prepare a student to take CIW Certificate Internet Webmaster exams.
For more information on CIW exams, log on to www.ciwcertified.com.
Drop by the HFC Counseling Office or log on to the web at hfcc.edu.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan is a comprehensive public college serving about 18,000 students each year in Southeast Michigan. HFC is dedicated to preparing students for the rapidly changing workplace in today's world by offering more than 100 associate degree and university transfer programs. HFC also specializes in customized workforce development training for business and industry. Since its founding in 1938, HFC has been the gateway to higher education for thousands of students who seek an affordable, high-quality post-secondary education. To learn more about what HFC has to offer, please visit us at www.hfcc.edu or you can call the campus office at 1-800-585-HFCC. Your future begins now, and it begins right here at Henry Ford College.
Today, a new creature walks among us, causing fear, mayhem, and injury.
Stay back, children.
Look out for the dreaded digital deadwalkers. With faces pressed against their little handheld devices, they put all good citizens in harm's way.
Hey, dude, I'm walking here.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
A public service message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, who want to keep everyone well connected with healthy bones.
Tune in Sunday nights to the 1+1 show hosted by me, Mrs. Robinson. I will expand your musical horizons with a wide variety of indie rock, space rock, garage rock, electronic music, and scores. So tune in Sunday nights from 9 until midnight on the station making waves, WHFR.FM.
Hi, I'm Phil Mack, and I host Thematic and Primetime Thematic, and I am a volunteer DJ.
I'm Andy Parks, the host of Strictly Gospel right here on the station that's making waves, and I am a volunteer DJ.
Hi, this is Mike Holloway, host of the Go With The Flow Mike Holloway Show, and I am a volunteer DJ.
Hi, I'm Bill Keith. My program, Light From The Underground, and all the programs you hear on the station are curated by a dedicated staff of DJs who donate their time and effort to bring you independent, non-commercial radio programming. Thank you for listening.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When you think about this room, you think about it empty. You think about her in here with two FBI agents, her back against the wall. To me, it felt very intimidating. It would have been almost like a jail cell.
Former U.S. intelligence contractor Reality Lee Winner appeared in court this week in an orange jumpsuit and shackles, 9 months after she was arrested and charged with violating the Espionage Act. The government claims she leaked a top secret document about Russian interference in the 2016 election to The Intercept. We'll speak with Reality's mother, Billie Winner Davis, at her daughter's home, where Reality was arrested by FBI agents. Then, in 1961, an 18-year-old African-American student walked onto the campus of the University of Georgia into the pages of history. She became one of two black students to desegregate the school. Her name, Charlene Hunter. From surviving school desegregation and finding hope and never again, we'll speak with legendary journalist, now Charlene Hunter Gault. She has a message for today's historic student movement for gun control.
Each generation out of relative obscurity has to find their own cause and embrace it or reject it. But I just want them to know that the power they have within them, because it was young people who changed the face of the South at, you know, uprooting decades of a certain kind of law that didn't regard people as equal.
All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, Republican lawmakers said Thursday they're moving on from the debate over gun control after failing to pass a single bill on firearms in the wake of last month's mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, which killed 17 people at Stoneman Douglas High School. The congressional inaction came as President Trump appeared to backpedal Thursday from his surprise announcement a day earlier that stunned so many when he said he supports comprehensive gun control measures. Chris Cox, a top lobbyist with the National Rifle Association, tweeted after a meeting with Trump and Vice President Pence last night, quote, POTUS and VPOTUS support the Second Amendment, support strong due process, and don't want gun control, Cox tweeted. Trump followed up, tweeting, good, great meeting in the Oval Office tonight with the NRA. Trump's backpedaling came just one day after he publicly chided Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey for being afraid of the NRA.
It doesn't make sense that I have to wait till I'm 21 to get a handgun, but I can get this weapon at 18. I don't know. So I was just curious as to what you did in your bill.
We didn't address it, Mr. President. Look, I think
you know why? Because you're afraid of the NRA, right?
No, not an issue.
Meanwhile, state lawmakers in Georgia approved a bill Thursday punishing Delta Airlines for its decision to end a promotional discount for members of the NRA. The bill, which Republican Governor Nathan Deal has pledged to sign, ends a proposed $50 million sales tax break on jet fuel that would have benefited Delta. President Trump announced Thursday he's imposing still new tariffs on imports of foreign steel and aluminum in a move that sent world stock markets tumbling amidst fears of a new trade war. The new tariffs, 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum, will benefit U.S. producers of the metals while raising prices for companies that manufacture everything from cars to airplanes to high-rise apartments. The announcement prompted fears that other countries will impose retaliatory tariffs while challenging U.S. protectionism at the World Trade Organization. Russian President Vladimir Putin said Thursday his nation has developed a new arsenal of invincible nuclear weapons that can reach, quote, anywhere in the world. Among the weapons claimed by Putin is a nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed cruise missile with unlimited range, a nuclear torpedo, and a new class of submarine-launched long-range missiles. Putin's announcement comes just weeks after the Trump administration unveiled its new nuclear weapons strategy, which involves spending at least $1.2 trillion to upgrade the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Nobel Peace Laureate Beatrice Finn of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons responded to the news, writing, Putin's statement makes it clear we are in a new arms race that will put us under the terror of a new Cold War, in constant fear of death at any instant. While Russia and the U.S. compare the size of their arsenals, the rest of the world is joining a treaty that bans them, she wrote. In Syria, aid groups are warning of a humanitarian catastrophe in the Damascus suburb of eastern Ghouta after a daily humanitarian pause and fighting failed to materialize. This is a resident of eastern Ghouta speaking in a video posted on a social media site.
What truce, brother? Look at the destruction. Barrel bombs are dropping on us. What truce? Until today, there were barrel bombs and no homes are left. Nothing is left. Look at the destruction. There is no food or drink or anything at all. You cannot work. What truce? We do not want to leave the city. We do not want corridors. We are staying here and will remain resistant. We just want al-Assad to stop the strikes.
The Syrian Civil Defense, also known as the White Helmets, said today 674 civilians have been killed in Syrian government-led airstrikes and artillery attacks over the past 2 weeks. The Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations says two of eastern Ghouta's hospitals have been bombed since Saturday and that more than 1,100 sick and wounded residents are at risk of dying if they are not immediately evacuated. CNN reports FBI investigators are looking into whether White House senior advisor Ivanka Trump's business dealings leave her vulnerable to pressure by foreign agents. The investigation is centered around financing for the $360 million Trump International Hotel and Tower in Vancouver, Canada, which opened after President Trump took office. The project was led by a powerful Malaysian investor through a Canada-based development company. Investigators are reportedly looking into whether the flow of foreign money through the project might be influencing White House policy. The investigation comes as part of the first daughter's bid to obtain full security clearance to read top secret documents. Her husband, also White House advisor Jared Kushner, has been denied such clearance and was stripped of his temporary top secret clearance earlier this week. This comes after the New York Times reported Kushner's real estate company received loans worth $500 million from two separate investors after he met with powerful financial executives at the White House, executives from Citigroup and Apollo. President Trump said Thursday the U.S. should impose the death penalty on drug dealers, praising countries like the Philippines that apply capital punishment to drug traffickers. Trump made the remarks during a White House summit on the opioid crisis.
If you want to be weak and you want to talk about just blue ribbon committees, that's not the answer. The answer is you have to have strength and you have to have toughness. The drug dealers, the drug pushers are, they're really doing damage. They're really doing damage. Some countries have a very, very tough penalty, the ultimate penalty. And by the way, they have much less of a drug problem than we do.
Trump's comments come just weeks after the International Criminal Court opened a preliminary investigation into accusations that Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte had committed crimes against humanity by overseeing the killing of up to 8,000 people in his so-called war on drugs. A new report finds the gains of the civil rights movement have stalled and in some cases lost ground over the past half century. Among the report's findings, school segregation is on the rise, white supremacist movements are becoming emboldened and more violent, and child poverty has increased from 15.5% in 1968 to 21% today. The report comes on the 50-year anniversary of a report by the Kerner Commission, which was assembled by President Lyndon Johnson in the wake of uprisings by African Americans in Newark and Detroit. The commission concluded the United States was, quote, moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. In Louisiana, newly disclosed documents reveal a state intelligence agency regularly spied on activists opposing the construction of the Bayou Bridge pipeline, which would carry nearly 500,000 barrels of oil per day across Louisiana's wetlands. The documents show the Louisiana Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness regularly drafted intelligence memos on anti-pipeline activists, including a gathering of indigenous-led water protectors who've set up a protesting encampment along the pipeline's route. Other newly revealed documents show close coordination between Louisiana regulators and the company building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners. In some cases, state regulators use language drafted by the pipeline company in its public documents. This comes just 1 week after a U.S. district judge in Baton Rouge ordered a temporary injunction against the construction of the Bayou Bridge pipeline in order to, quote, prevent further irreparable harm, unquote, to the region's delicate ecosystems while court challenges proceed. Energy Transfer Partners owns the Dakota Access Pipeline as well. Christian evangelical leader Billy Graham will be laid to rest at a funeral in North Carolina today after his death last month at the age of 99. On Wednesday, Graham's body was laid in honor in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, where politicians, including President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, paid their respects. Graham is the first religious leader to lay in state in the Capitol and the first private citizen since civil rights leader Rosa Parks was honored there in 2005. The decision to honor Billy Graham drew fire from many civil rights activists who say the religious leader was an apologist for racist and sexist views among evangelicals. University of Pennsylvania professor Anthea Butler wrote, quote, Graham would have told Parks that she needed to obey the law, stay at home, and be content with being a black woman with no rights, unquote. And U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is blocking the release of a video showing protesters confronting him over the Trump administration's policies during an appearance at the University of California, Los Angeles. About 400 people attended Monday's free event at UCLA Lecture Hall, which the university filmed, as it typically does for guest speakers. But Mnuchin withdrew his consent to have the video posted online after he was repeatedly confronted by protesters who called out Mnuchin's support for President Trump's tax cuts and his record of foreclosing on homes during his tenure as CEO of One West Bank. Parts of Mnuchin's appearance were captured on cell phone cameras and posted to social media. This is UCLA geography major Tala Deloria, who was lifted from her seat and hauled away by campus police after she confronted Mnuchin.
We know that the tax bill and what that represents is sentencing people to death, including children, 9 billion children who are going to be left without health care. So this system that is putting people in this position in the first place, that actually moved the jobs overseas, it wasn't black people and brown people in the inner cities who did this, and yet you are punishing them for being in that position. You are punishing them for the misery that this system, the system that you're enforcing,
time for you to leave.
Is committing.
At that point, the geography major, Tala Deloria, was hauled off by police on campus. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show with updates in the case of former U.S. intelligence contractor Reality Lee Winner, who's facing up to 10 years in prison on charges she violated the Espionage Act. Winner is a former National Security Agency contractor who's pleaded not guilty to charges she leaked a top-secret document to The Intercept about Russian interference in the 2016 election. Reality Winner was arrested by FBI agents at her home in Augusta, Georgia, on June 3rd, 2 days before The Intercept published an expose revealing Russian military intelligence conducted a cyber attack on at least one U.S. voting software company just days before the U.S. presidential election last November. The expose was based on a classified NSA report from May 5, 2017, that shows the agency is convinced the Russian General Staff Main Intelligence Directorate, or GRU, was responsible for interfering in the 2016 presidential election. Reality is the first whistleblower to be accused of violating the Espionage Act under the Trump administration. She's been denied bail and has been jailed since June. On Tuesday, she appeared in court in Augusta, Georgia, in orange jumpsuit and shackles, where her lawyers asked the judge to exclude her statements to the FBI agents on the day she was arrested, arguing she was denied her Miranda rights. Well, we're joined right now by two guests. In Chicago, Kevin Gostela is with us, managing editor of Shadowproof Press. He's been covering Reality Winner's case and has just come back from Augusta. He's also covered several whistleblower cases, including Chelsea Manning's. He was in the courtroom in Augusta Tuesday, and his recent articles headlined, "In Reality Winner's Case, Defense Seizes Upon FBI Testimony to Bolster Motion to Suppress Statements." But first, we go to Augusta, Georgia, where we're joined by Reality Winner's mother, Billy Winner Davis. She's joining us from her daughter's home, where Reality was questioned and arrested by FBI agents on June 3rd. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Billy Winner Davis, let's begin with you. As you sit in Reality's home, talk about what you understood happened that first weekend of June in 2017. Walk us through this.
Well, on June 3rd, Reality returned from a trip to the grocery store, and she was immediately approached by male FBI agents at her home. They advised her that they had a search warrant. They had search warrants for her home, her car, and her person. She cooperated with them fully. They took her cell phone. They took her keys. They asked her if she had a place, if she wanted to basically be interviewed here at her home or if she wanted to go down to the FBI office. She agreed to be interviewed here at her home. They asked if she had a place that they could interview her that was away from everything. She advised them that she did have a spare back room, a bedroom here in the house. She advised them that she was not comfortable going into that room. She called the room creepy and weird. They nevertheless led her to that room to interview her with regard to their investigation. This week in court, her lawyers argued that basically the actions that the FBI agents took were actions that confined her. They had her in their custody. She never felt at any time that she was free to leave. And in fact, her actions during the interview and during the whole process told them that she felt like she wasn't free to leave. She asked for permission to move about. She asked for permission to even use the restroom, which they gave her. She was at all times accompanied by agents. And on that day, it was 11 FBI agents that came into this home to either interview her or search her. And so, and it is a very small home. And so basically, I get the impression that it was very frightening. It was very intimidating for her that day.
Billy, the FBI agents were armed?
Yes, from what we've learned, 9 of the 11 FBI agents and personnel here at her home that day were armed.
And they immediately took her cell phone and her car keys, and they said, and they took her into that room that she has described as creepy.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. And at no point did they return her cell phone to her, return her car keys to her. We saw photographs which definitely showed that her car was surrounded. There would have been no physical way for her to even leave in her vehicle if she wanted to. And so the argument that the defense made this week was a strong one,
so
that she was basically being held here.
Was she read her Miranda rights?
Yes, ma'am. No, she was never read her Miranda rights, and the FBI agents did admit to that. They did admit that at no time did they read her Miranda rights, or did they feel like they had to do that.
And this is what's at issue, is that right? Her lawyers want to suppress her statements to the FBI, saying she was not read her Miranda rights, not told she could remain silent or have a lawyer with her.
That's correct. That's correct.
Kevin Gostala, you've not only covered this trial, but others. Can you talk further about what this means, what happened to reality on that day?
Which goes to, due process issues and whether a person has a right to remain silent. One of the aspects of the law that is at issue here is something that I didn't really know until this case existed, a concept called custodial interrogation. And FBI agents apparently can come into your home, and if you're not in a police-dominated atmosphere, if a court of law doesn't determine that police took over this area, then in fact you were never detained or arrested, and they can basically manipulate or have their way with you. And so what the judge is looking at here is whether enough factors appear where she is actually in custody. And if that's the case, if the judge agrees with the defense, what they've listed off and what Billy was talking about, then in fact the judge may rule that her rights were violated. And some other things that were talked about is the fact that she had a search warrant for her person, or the FBI had a search warrant for her person. And when they came there, the government wants to maintain that they executed it when they took the cell phone. But about 28 minutes into this whole encounter, another agent who did not take the stand, Wally Taylor, said something about still having a search warrant for her person. Nobody is free to leave if the FBI still has a search warrant to execute against you. And so clearly, she couldn't have left her home and just wandered to the convenience store, as the government talked during the hearing. Another aspect that's important is that she was regarded, even before this encounter, as someone who was a danger to the community. That's how the FBI viewed her. They also viewed her as a potential target of foreign intelligence. One way that the defense really tried to poke at the government's arguments that they didn't do anything wrong was to say that if you have somebody in their home and they're isolated in this way and they're surrounded by a surveillance team, you're not really going to let them leave and go into the community. You know, if we're going to follow your logic, you wouldn't have let Reality Winner leave her house.
So, Billy Winter Davis, you know your daughter well. She's an Air Force veteran. Her rank, senior airman. Her last duty, cryptologic language analyst. She had been stationed at Fort Meade, Maryland, before working in Augusta. That military training, with having FBI come in, what would be her assumption, now stripped of phone, car keys, asking to go to the bathroom?
Right. All of her actions that day, and when you read the transcript and we heard clips of the audio, all of her actions that day told us that she never felt like she was free to leave. And I know in talking with her shortly after the incident, she did indicate to me that she was frightened. I heard her voice on the audio. I heard it shaking. the prosecution tried to make it seem that this was a very casual encounter, almost like one that would occur at Starbucks. But what I heard on the audio was far from that. Her voice was shaking. Yes, she was making small talk and she was making jokes and she was laughing, but that's out of nervousness. They twisted a lot of things to try to make it look like this was a very mild encounter that she had with FBI agents at her home. But anyone puts themselves in her position, 11 male armed FBI agents, 9 of them armed, but 11 male FBI agents have come into your home. 2 of them have taken you to the back room in your house where you have already told them you are not comfortable. You are asking permission to make any movements in your home. She was never under the impression that she was free to leave. And therefore, I believe she was in their custody.
Billy Winner Davis and Kevin Gostolo, we have to break. We're going to come back to this discussion. Billy Winner Davis is the mother of Reality Winner, who faces 10 years in prison. She's been now jailed for 9 months, brought into a courtroom this week in an orange jumpsuit and shackles. We'll also continue with Kevin Gostolo, speaking to us from Chicago, just back from Augusta, where the courtroom scene played out this week. Stay with us.
I'm the last leaf on the tree. The autumn took the rest, but it won't take me. I'm the last leaf on the tree. When the autumn wind blows, they've already gone. They flutter to the ground, 'cause they can't hang. And there's nothing in the world that I ain't seen. I greet all of the new ones that are coming in green. And I'm the last leaf on the tree. The autumn took the rest, but it won't take me.
Last Leaf by Joan Baez from her new album Whistle Down the Wind, released today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing to cover the case of former U.S. intelligence contractor Reality Lee Winner, who's facing up to 10 years in prison on charges of violating the Espionage Act. She's now been jailed for 9 months on charges she leaked a top-secret document to The Intercept about Russian interference in the September in the U.S. elections. We're joined by Reality's mother, Billy Winner. Winner Davis and Kevin Gostolo, a journalist who's covering this trial intensively, was just in Augusta this week in the courtroom. I want to turn now to Billy Winner Davis showing Democracy Now! This morning the room where the FBI questioned her daughter, Reality.
According to the FBI agents and my daughter, she was with her back up against this wall, and there would have been an agent here, standing here on this corner, and an agent either on this wall or this wall. They're not really sure. But so she was kind of triangled in by the agents, her back up against that wall again. According to her, the door was nearly shut. The agents were not clear on their recollection as to whether the door was shut or not. And so when you think about this room, you think about it empty. You think about her in here with 2 FBI agents, her back against the wall. To me, it felt very intimidating. It would have been almost like a jail cell.
So that's Billy Winner Davis, mother of Reality, in that back room that Reality called creepy, where the FBI held her and questioned her. Kevin Gostolo, you were in court with Billy's family this week when her lawyer, Reality's lawyers, asked to suppress her statements, believing that she was not read her Miranda rights, which the FBI agreed she was not, saying she was not free to leave. At least she didn't believe she was. Can you describe how unusual it was that reality was brought in shackles and orange jumpsuit. You've covered a number of these trials.
Yeah, well, I was stunned to see her brought into the room in an orange jumpsuit. I'd covered other cases similar to this, and I was under the assumption that she would be brought into a back room, allowed to change into whatever she wanted to wear, and then brought out in those clothes. And when she entered, she had shackles on her feet. She had cuffs. They brought her all the way up to the defense table and then took the handcuffs off. I believe they kept the shackles on her legs, so she sat down with those. And then another aspect that I found striking was that they had a marshal. There were two U.S. marshals that were escorting her. One of the marshals sat right in front of her during the entire hearing as it unfolded. He was in her face. He was never staring her down, but he was seated in a way where his body was turned, and he was looking towards a corner of the courtroom. And this, to me, just seemed to be really overboard. And I compared it to what I experienced covering Chelsea Manning's trial. And I know it's far, far different, but my memory of that was so vivid of Chelsea just walking in, the marshal allowing her to take her seat. There weren't any handcuffs, never any shackles on Chelsea's feet. And it just seems to me that what's going on here is some serious dehumanization of somebody right before a judge's very eyes. Mm.
And talk about the fact that she has been held in jail for 9 months, denied bail, and how that compares to previous cases.
Yeah, this is very remarkable, even if we just look at federal cases. I know you've covered the Jeffrey Sterling case, a CIA whistleblower who was prosecuted. He just got out of prison. In fact, before he went to trial, he was not in jail. I know that you've covered CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou, and he's been on this program. He was not in pretrial detention before he went to trial or before he had a chance to go through some of his pretrial hearings. Eventually, he pled guilty to a charge. And so in this case, she's been put behind bars because the government wants to argue that she could be a target of foreign intelligence and a danger to the community. And even more troubling, even more disturbing to me, the judge is allowing the government to argue that she probably hates America, and that makes her someone who should be kept in jail. And I don't know regulations as well as a lawyer, but to me it seems like that kind of an opinion shouldn't make you somebody who is denied bail. On top of that, there are several ways in which you can control the movement of a person so that they can be guaranteed to show up to hearings or to their trial. You can put an ankle bracelet on them, which is one thing that she's willing to do. You can have your passport seized. Reality's willing to go through that. I understand that her parents were willing to put up collateral in order to cover the home, and then she would be put on home confinement, and that would be a way in order to ensure that she didn't flee. But the government has crafted the story of Reality as some kind of super spy, even though the FBI agents said in their interrogation that they didn't believe that she was this kind of a person. They've created this narrative of some kind of super spy who possibly, you know, sympathizes with the Taliban even. Very obscenely, they were talking in court about how she had done searches on her computer for how to follow the Taliban without the government detecting that. And so they're really trying to keep her in jail and really go after her in similar ways that they've done to other whistleblowers.
I just want to quote the judge in this case, Federal Judge Brian Epps of Augusta, Georgia, who said his decision to deny bail was based in part on social media comments by Reality that she, quote, admires Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. So if you, Kevin Gostala, can talk about exactly what Reality Winner is charged with, what the government is saying she did.
She's accused of gathering and releasing classified information without authorization. It's under the Espionage Act. This is a 1910s era law. We're going back over a century here. Originally, this would have been used against dissenters in this period. It was a way to go after people who, you know, I understand were accused of seditious crimes. But in fact, in this case, there's no evidence at all that she had any communication with any agent of a foreign power. There's no evidence that she was providing anything to any spies. And none of the agents make that allegation at all. In fact, she could have been charged with a misdemeanor, just like David Petraeus was charged with a misdemeanor of unauthorized removal or retention of classified information. They chose to go after her with this felony charge. They chose to continue the same process that was perfected by the Justice Department under President Barack Obama and used it against several individuals while he was president. And they've chosen to really make an example out of her. And I don't think it has anything to do necessarily with the content of the information. It has to do with the zealous view that the Justice Department has about individuals who are low-level employees of the government who engage in this kind of action. And we also know that Attorney General Jeff Sessions is somebody who has a particular disdain for leaks, has always been supremely disgusted by this. And in fact, one of the things that he announced back in August of 2017 is that they were starting a counterintelligence division inside the FBI that would be particularly handling these cases. Now, that was after Reality Winner's arrest and after this case came to their attention. But they've almost tripled the number of unauthorized disclosure cases that they're pursuing at the Justice Department just in the first years of the Trump administration when you compare it to the Obama administration. Those are Jeff Sessions' own words. And so they're really going after her here, and they intend to put as much pressure on her. I believe that what they're doing by keeping her in prison is intended to make her plead guilty and not go to trial. And they would like her to roll over and accept some time in jail and not defend herself.
So I want to go through the timeline, Kevin and Billy. On the day that Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, May 9, 2017, Reality would later be charged with finding and printing a classified report entitled Russia Cybersecurity Main Intelligence Director Cyber Actors. The next day was May 10th. Trump celebrated with Russian officials in the White House, bragging he had fired nutjob Comey in order to end any Russiagate investigation. Hours later, according to the government, Reality allegedly sent the NSA report to the media May 11th. And the quote of Reality, "Why do I have this job if I'm just going to sit back and be helpless? I just thought that was the final straw." That's what Reality allegedly explained under interrogation, saying, "I felt really hopeless seeing that information contested. Why isn't this out there? Why can't this be public?" Now, again, this is allegedly what she said. We weren't there. She was there with the FBI agents. And this is all material that her lawyers are asking to suppress. But talk about the significance of this timeline and the document that The Intercept published that the government alleges is from Reality Winner, although it turns out now that the government learned, because they can figure out these things, that this was printed by a number of different people, printed something like six times. Kevin.
Yes, that's my understanding. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, let me go to Kevin, and then Billy, I want to go back to you.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Yeah, the government says it was printed six times. That was in the indictment. They also claim that none of those individuals had emailed The Intercept, and so it has to be Reality Winner. Of course, that doesn't consider the possibility that maybe those other individuals were able to conceal their communications in ways that are probably far too well known to the government. But I think what's important is that this document was something where, you know, it showed that alleged hackers were targeting voter registration systems. It raised issues that were actually prominent in the media. This was something that people were discussing. And in fact, this very story was something that was back in the press, not Only three or four weeks ago, we were talking about it because other news media were confirming details of this report and pursuing it. And so I think it's really important for this information to be out. And I also think it's important that we talk about what it was that she revealed, because it shows you that what she did was, in fact, a whistleblower act if she is the person who revealed this report, because it's not like she was just reckless. It's not like she just was inside of her office and using the access she had in order to gain some kind of popularity. She actually read this document and was concerned about it. And in fact, if we're to believe the confession, the agents even recognize that she is probably somebody who's angry about politics, and they recognize that she's somebody who's frustrated by Donald Trump's election, and that, in fact, the reason why she probably released this document has something to do with that.
Billy, before we lose the satellite feed to you in Augusta, Georgia, in Reality's home, where you are now, just tell us about your daughter. Tell us about Reality. You're not able to have contact visits with her this last 9 months, last seeing her in the courtroom in that orange jumpsuit. How do you visit her? How do you talk to her? Who's listening?
They are listening. The prosecution is monitoring everything. The NSA is monitoring everything. All of her incoming and outgoing mail is sent to the NSA for scanning. And all of our conversations, of course, are recorded. She is able to call me freely as long as we keep funds on her books at the jail. She's able to purchase calling cards and call us. So she does call me daily. I'm able to visit with her as long as I'm here in Georgia. I'm able to visit with her on Saturday and Sunday mornings. Each visit is kept at 30 minutes, and it is between glass, and it is over a phone. It is being monitored. You're correct. During this entire time, she has not had to have any, she has not been allowed to have any contact visits whatsoever. We have not been able to touch our daughter. I have not been able to hug her. Seeing her in the courtroom brought in the orange jumpsuit with the inmate marked on it, seeing her shackled, seeing her handcuffed, seeing the way that they're treating her, it is something that really causes me a lot of pain, a lot of emotional pain, to see her treated like that. Hmm. And it's been very, very difficult. These last 9 months have been extremely difficult, and we know that we've got a long road ahead of us.
Billy, talk about Reality and her chosen profession. I mean, she is an Air Force veteran. She is a cybersecurity expert. Just talk about her career. When did she go into the military, and then what did she do from there to now?
Yes. She joined the military right after high school graduation. And in fact, she was looking into the military while she was still in high school. She went into the Air Force directly after her high school graduation in December of 2010, I want to say. And she went into the military. She wanted to be a linguist, and she wanted to be a Middle Eastern linguist. They did train her. They trained her to speak Farsi, Dari, and Pashto. She was very good at her job. She served her country very well. Prior to her discharge, her honorable discharge from the Air Force, she did receive a commendation medal for the work that she did. And, you know, it specifies all that she did for her country. It specifies how important she was. It lists out that she was instrumental in identifying and capturing over 600 targets while she was employed as a linguist for the Air Force. Following her discharge from the Air Force, she did look into ways that she could actually go to the Middle East, to Iran, Afghanistan, Syria, to actually help there. She wanted to do humanitarian aid there. She had applied to different organizations, but she had not been able to secure a job with those humanitarian organizations. So she did relocate back to Augusta, where she had been deployed. She had been deployed to Augusta during her time in the Air Force as well. She relocated back here to Augusta.
She had friends here. She knew that she had a job teaching spinning and yoga here in Augusta. And then she did gain employment with a contract agency here in Augusta, and she began her employment at the NSA in February of 2017, I believe. My years kind of get mixed up, so I apologize if I'm not correct with that. So Reality is extremely passionate and compassionate. She goes out of her way to better her communities. She has done volunteer work. She's done community service work. When she was in Maryland, she was part of a group called Athletes Serving Athletes, where she ran marathons with disabled youth. She was fostering a dog here while she was in Augusta. She has always been very involved in service work, and that's who she is. And always trying to better her world, better her planet, better her country.
Kevin,
so we're very proud of Reality. I'm very proud.
Kevin Gostola, the issue of not releasing her, suggesting she is a threat, can you talk about this? And though Russian interference in the elections was not her specialty, why this might have concerned her?
I think she was concerned because she's a citizen just like everybody else in this country. And if it looks like our voter registration systems are vulnerable to hacking by Russians or Chinese or Iranians or any other country, that's something to be concerned about. And I think, you know, one way to tie it to the current news here is if the government really wants to pursue this logic that Reality Winner can be a target of foreign intelligence because of the way she allegedly mishandled or made this unauthorized disclosure of classified information, then possibly we should have Jared Kushner or Ivanka Trump hauled into a jail cell just so that they can be isolated and protected so that they can't be targeted and manipulated by foreign intelligence. I mean, because that's really the logic that the government has been using here, is that because of what's in her head and because she knows and because of the service that she has done for this country, she is someone who is vulnerable to attacks by people. So they not only are upset with her views, but they're also upset by the fact that she knows secrets and they lost control of her.
Billy Winter Davis, we're going to end with you. I wanted to ask you about the name, your daughter's name, Reality Winter. Why did you choose Reality?
It wasn't me. It was her dad. When we had our first child, I named the first child. I was able to pick out her name. And so when I became pregnant with Reality and we found out it was a girl, their dad at that time, he said, well, you know, you named the first child, I get to name the second child. And the last name is Winner, which is rather unique. And he stated that he wanted a real winner. And so he named her Reality. And throughout her life, it has just fit her perfectly. She is a very unique, special person. It's a beautiful name. It fits her personality. It fits who she is.
And Billy, what do you want for your daughter right now?
What I want for her, what I need, is for everybody to keep her in the focus. Say her name. I want everybody to know who Reality Winner is and what is happening to Reality Winner. It's very, very important that she be remembered and that people not forget what she is going through, the battle that she faces, that she is being silenced, that she is being hidden away, she is locked away. And I really want everybody to remember her name, to speak her name, to talk about her.
Billy Winter Davis, thanks so much for joining us, inviting us into your daughter's home. Your daughter, Reality Winter, now currently jailed in Georgia. The trial for Reality is set for what date, Billy?
We do not have a trial date at this point. The trial was originally scheduled for October, and then it was pushed to March. But as of right now, we do not have a new trial date. So we don't know when she will be
face the jury. What I'm being told is that it will be late 2018, if not early February 2019.
Which means she could continue to be ahead of us. Which means she could continue to be in prison until that time.
That's correct. That is correct. We lost the appeal for bail, and so yes, she no longer has any other options to fight for bond or bail.
Billy Winner Davis, thanks so much for being with us, mother of Reality Winner, and Kevin Gostala, managing editor of Shadowproof, a journalist covering Reality Winner's case. He has covered a number of them, including Chelsea Manning, and will link to his piece in Reality Winner's case, Defense Seizes Upon FBI Testimony to Bolster Motion to Suppress Statements. When we come back, in 1961, an 18-year-old African-American student walked onto the campus of the University of Georgia and into the history books, desegregating the University of Georgia. Her name, Charlene Hunter. In a moment, we'll speak with Charlene Hunter Gault about surviving school desegregation and finding hope in Never Again. Stay with us.
Get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children, get on board, children, children.
Peacock, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, from school desegregation to never again. As a student-led movement for gun control sweeps the country, led by the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School students who survived the mass shooting that killed 17 of their classmates and teachers, we're going to spend the rest of the hour looking back at a key moment in history, a key moment in another historic student movement, desegregation. It was January 9, 1961, that two black students, Charlene Hunter and Hamilton Holmes, walked onto the campus of the University of Georgia to register for classes as a howling mob of white students screamed racial epithets at them. It was a pivotal movement in the African-American student-led movement to desegregate America's public high schools and universities. On that day, Charlene Hunter was just shy of 19 years old, one of the first two African-American students to enroll at the University of Georgia. After winning a landmark legal case, she'd long dreamed of being a journalist, and at the time, the University of Georgia had the best journalism program in the state. 2 days after she registered for classes, a white mob gathered outside her dorm room, hurling bricks at the building, smashing windows. The university suspended her and Hamilton Holmes, supposedly for their own safety. Again, the students took their battle to the court, soon returned to campus. Charlene Hunter graduated in 1963, took her first job in journalism as an editorial assistant at The New Yorker. She went on to have an award-winning career in journalism, working for PBS, NPR, CNN, won two Emmys, two Peabody Awards. In 1988, the legendary journalist, now Charlene Hunter Gault, returned to the University of Georgia's campus to make more history, become the university's first African-American graduation speaker. Well, Charlene Hunter Gault joins us now from Sarasota, Florida, the award-winning journalist, author of many books, including In My Place, a memoir of her childhood and her years at the University of Georgia. It's great to speak to you again, Charlene. Talk about that moment as we look at the student-led movement that is rocking this country, March 24th, the March for Our Lives, which Democracy Now! Will be covering in Washington, D.C. Let's go back to the movement that you began on the University of Georgia campus. Walk us through it as you walked on campus that day.
Well, Amy, let me first say it's nice to see you again. Last time I saw you was on Martha's Vineyard, and it was a very wonderful experience. And despite the things that went on back in 1961, it was a wonderful experience. I think it prepared me for what I call my journey to the horizons. Hamilton Holmes and I felt entitled because our parents paid taxes. The University of Georgia was a state institution, and our parents' taxes paid for it. It had been all white for 170 some years, but we felt entitled. We were citizens of the state of Georgia. And at the same time that we were applying to the University of Georgia, a student movement not only in Atlanta but across the South was suborning to challenge the unjust law of separate and unequal, although it was called separate but equal. And so when we entered, when we won the case with Vernon Jordan and Donald Hollowell and Constance Motley and Horace Ward, Vernon is the one remaining legal person who was involved with our case. The others are now our ancestors, but they were very much alive then and very, very determined to right what was wrong with the laws in Georgia, particularly as it related to the university. We paid very little attention to the students who were yelling at us and calling us ugly words because we had a mission. Our mission was to enroll at the University of Georgia and pursue our dreams. Hamilton wanted to be a doctor, which he eventually became, graduating from the University of Georgia under all that pressure as a Phi Beta Kappa. He wanted to play football, but initially he played football at our high school in Atlanta, Turner High School, but the officials told him that if he played, he could either be hurt by his own football players or by the all-white players at all of the other schools, because the University of Georgia was the first school to desegregate. So all of the other schools in the state were all-white still. And so that was a big disappointment to him, but he concentrated then on his studies. And as I said, he graduated with the top honors in his class. It might seem to outsiders to have been a trying time, and the night the students rioted outside of our dormitory, throwing a brick or two through my window, it was a little bit trying because I was told Hamilton didn't know the riot was going on because the girls had to live on the campus, boys didn't. That was a Southern way of doing things in those days. But the one slightly fearsome thing was that I didn't know what was going on outside. The police managed to take their time getting there to disperse the rioters. They did it with tear gas. And so going into that dark night with officials that whom I didn't know whether I could trust or not was a little bit strange, but it wasn't frightening somehow. We got through it. I got through it, met Hamilton, who lived about 5 minutes away from the campus with a black family who were brave enough to take him in. And
broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener supported, non-commercial radio.
The longest highway that I